Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, capital budgeting. Now, this will obviously carry over into Wednesday's lecture because we do end, so you can take quiz six today after I've done the introduction to capital budgeting and done my usual let's look at the numbers, which is what we're about to do here. And as you can see, it was a very tepid day. You see the Dow was down about 0.5%, but the S&P managed to squeeze out a little bit of a positive at 0.17%, and the NASDAQ came in almost 0.5%. So it's kind of like a mixed message that you're getting from all of the different markets, the exchanges and the indexes. And it's the thing of it is that, let me show you something down here. This is the sector map that I've shown you before. Do you notice this? Technology sector is one of the few bull sectors today, but it is so large, and I will show you how large it is here in a minute or two, that even if it comes up a little bit, it gives a distorted view of the overall markets and the overall economy in a way, because these companies in that technology sector, they are going to keep going up. As I said, even if we go into a pretty serious recession, those companies are still going to be successful because they are the companies that are going to eliminate the workforce in favor of artificial intelligence and robots and all kinds of other mechanisms for doing their work. And so they can keep going higher and higher, even if the economy itself is going into a crash and burn scenario. And so I'll show you more about that here in a minute, but we'll go back up here and look at the rest of the markets. The markets were in, well, let me back this down a little bit so I can see some percentages. There we go. As you can see, Japan, the Tokyo Exchange, as shown by the, where is the Nikkei? Oh, the Nikkei, it was actually doing pretty well today. It had a really nice, good day up. Now, one of the parts of that that is interesting is that there have been rumbles and rumors about Japan sliding into a recession over the next few quarters. And you're seeing, though, that the Nikkei, the 225 at least, and the Tokyo Exchange in general, seems to be shaking off the possibility of a recession. And that may or may not be what will happen, but it seems like they may have been able to, at least to some extent, soften the fall if they do slide to a recession. And part of that, they are working very hard to consolidate other markets, markets other than the United States, because they see ours as just a no-win situation with these massive tariffs that are being put on those kinds on Japanese cars and vehicles from other countries. So they do face challenges finding other markets, but they are fairly successful already in doing so. And going to over to Europe, as you can see, Europe started out pretty well, and then it kind of slid back. It finished above where it started the day, but it wasn't all that great. And the CAC, the Paris CAC 40 on the Paris Exchange, did slip a little bit, but not terribly by the end of the trading today over there. And so did London. It started out okay, and then it began to tail downward, but still it wasn't any kind of a massive drop-off for the day. So Europe and Asia are doing okay. Now let me take you down here for just a minute or two. Notice that the 10-year, we had gotten the yield on the benchmark 10-year bond kind of the leading interest rate for interest rates in general. It had gotten below 4%, and that was a really good thing. But it is beginning to come back up again, and there are a couple of factors that are going to be driving that. One of the biggest factors will be that the U.S. budget deficits are skyrocketing. They've always been a problem, but now they are just going through the roof. And the problem with that is that that means that the government is going to have to borrow a lot of money in the possibly in the trillions of dollars. And that means that they will drive interest rates up because they will compete with private companies for capital. And they will simply bid up the interest rate. They'll offer whatever interest rate they have to get their money. That means that, in general, interest rates will be going up simply because the government is going to push those interest rates up. And that's why you're beginning to see that possibility of interest rates below 4%. It's kind of in the dust because the markets know the government's going to be coming, borrowing money. They will just drive up interest rates because they'll offer whatever interest rate they have to get the money to pay for all the government functions and services. And hence, we're going to have a higher interest rate environment. You're seeing it right now in that rising 10-year yield. And that will, of course, suppress economic activity. And you'll see a lot about that in the lecture on Wednesday, how higher interest rates are, why and how they kill off business activity. But anyway, moving over here, crude is still down there, ridiculously low, and it's going to bounce around in the low 60s, possibly the upper 50s, for the next at least 6 to 9 months, maybe a little longer than that. Now, gold, it had made it below $4,000 an ounce, but then it's beginning to show its muscle again, and I don't see it having a charge up to $5,000 from where it is right now, but it's definitely a lot higher now than it was even at the beginning of this semester. And that is, of course, a sign that there is a great deal of concern for some kind of an economic very bad situation within the year, because you're seeing these apocalyptic types of investors buying gold because they know gold will always be a currency for doing their business. Now, going down here, just one more mention of the sector map. It does show that overall the market was bearish, but because of the size, the sheer scale of the tech sector, there you go. It looks like it's better than it is. Now, let me take you on a little bit of a journey to show you how this actually works. We're going to look at some high-tech companies, NVIDIA. And we're going to specifically look at the market cap. That's the number of shares outstanding times the price per share. It is the market's assessment of the ownership value of the company. So we'll look at NVIDIA first. And go down here and look, first of all, notice NVIDIA just climbing up. The market was just barely crawling upward for the most part, but there's NVIDIA just blasting through the roof. And so here's the market cap right here. Let me expand that. Oops. So there you go. There's the market cap right there. $5 trillion. Insane. The size, the scale of that one company dwarfs most other companies. Now, if we add to that, let's have a look at Google, which is Alphabet. The company is Alphabet, but it still has Google as its name. So let's have a look at its market cap. Well, where is the market cap? I don't see the market cap. Market cap, there it is. $3.5 trillion. That's just two companies, and we're getting close to $10 trillion. Let's throw another one in there. Let's throw in Apple, AAPL. and see what its market cap. Well, there's another $4 trillion. You see why that technology sector, that sector map shows it so big? And when that's green, then it swamps all of the red. And you don't even notice it. Where the hell, did I just have a...
Crashed.
It crashed.
Restart.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sucks. Looks like that kicked my ass. Okay, there. Okay, that's Apple. Well, you know, we could throw in a few more companies, but you get the idea here. Now, let me show you what's going on, the relative scale of the consumer, the basic meat and potatoes kinds of companies. We could look at Colgate-Palmolive. They make things like toilet paper and shampoos and stuff to keep us from stinking. And they do a lot of other things. I want to look at that. The market cap is only $60 billion. Compared to those numbers in the multiple trillions, let's put a couple more in there. What was another one? Johnson & Johnson. You know, your nice things, baby powder, some vaccines. Let's have a look at them. $448.75 billion. Again, nowhere near the scale of the monsters. What was another one that I looked at? Procter and Gamble. See, that's why. Procter. PG. Let's look at them. More basics of our lives that we buy from this company. And Procter and Gamble, its market cap is $346 billion. Notice how much smaller these are. The companies that provide us with all the stuff that we need. We could look at a company like, for example, Archer Daniels Midland, supermarket to the world, the brokers of the grain across the planet, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland. Market cap on that one is a lousy $29 billion. You could just keep going on. The companies that function at the level of us and of the vast majority of companies in the B2B and the B2C, they are small compared to the technology sector. In other words, those technology companies that don't provide us with the essentials of our lives are absolutely swamping the companies that do. And the companies that do are not doing as well, at least in the sector analysis. So this is just something of a caution to you about being too much on the side of, oh, it's a bull market. Look at that, it's green overall. Well, that green is just so bright and so large, that light is, that it's hiding this ocean of very small companies that aren't doing as well right now. So we need to do that in our financial analysis. As critical thinkers, we can't just look at simple numbers. We have to dig in and understand how the depth of the issues involved. And that's my gripe today, just to keep you on track with how bearish I can be, even when you're hearing a lot of talk about how great everything is. There are a number of analysts who are now warning, as I have been, that we are in a very dangerous time. Now, what I want to do here is I want to show you something. This is the last spreadsheet, I promise you. But this one is another one of those home runs that make it a lot easier for you to do your work. Files. In the files. I said in the files. Mm-hmm. Let me not bother. Sorry about that. Yeah, there, files. Okay, now, if you go down, why does this suck? There we go. Okay, let's go down here. Go down to your spreadsheets. Really? Spreadsheets. Why can't I see the spreadsheets?
What's on there?
Oh, maybe so. Okay. Go back here. Oh, there it is. My bad. Okay, now, you go down here to the NPV and IRR Excel sheet. Now, download it. I won't be using it today, but I just want you to see it and explain it to you. But again, this is one of those that's going to make your work a lot easier to accomplish, doing calculations. Now, you'll see that the first one is NPV and IRR. It does both of them. And it also gives you a pretty little graph of what your NPV profile line looks like. Now, there are a couple of other ones. The payback period, modified internal rate of return. Now, I don't push the crossover rate. I will never ask you that on a test. It's a little bit too, you have to know how to look at them to know what it's saying to you, the graphs and all that. So I don't really push that one too much. But the break-even, it's old and it's not exactly the greatest theoretically, I suppose, but we all use it, especially in small businesses. No, and even in other sized businesses, middle-sized businesses, the break-even analysis is just something we all do. And I do it every year at the beginning of the selling seasons to see what I'm facing as far as how many of my artworks I have to sell. And it's just so ingrained in our business culture, we're never going to not use it. But this just gives you sort of a walkthrough. And again, as you can see, this is just one of those where you just push in numbers and out pops a nice result for you, just like the other ones. And I think you're getting really good at these Excel sheets in knowing where to put things, because your Excel problems, your quantitative problems are coming out really good on quizzes and on the exam. So this is just the last one that you have to put up with before your time with these is over. But anyway, I'm going to take this one down just to stop scaring you with it. Leave and then put that over there. So the first thing that I want you to do is, don't tell me you can't recognize my face. I even used my lotion this morning. See? It's me. There. Okay, go ahead and sign into your attendance radar. And now a little bit of a story time for you. And I do these because I want to convey to you that there is a history behind your subjects. And part of that history is intended to ensure that you don't think out of the box until you know what is in the box and why we are doing what we are doing, from our understandings and from our experience through not just years, but decades and centuries, and even through civilizations, that there is a story behind what we do in modern business. And the more we understand that story, the more we are prepared for what others would say is, well, we never saw that coming. Because we have, in a lot of cases. And even in this age of artificial intelligence, which is going to be wiping out jobs as it comes into the workplace and replaces us, you and me, We've seen elements of this before, and we kind of have an idea of the long story behind it. And this story begins actually before history. We know that business was being conducted before there was even writing. We know that. We see in one part of a continent things that are not from that part of the continent. They come from someplace else. Well, how did they do that? They were trading with each other. There was an incredibly well-established trade route through the middle of the United States, or even in this area, before there were any Europeans coming over here without legal status. It was there, and it was well-developed. We go back in history, we see all of these trading patterns all through the world. Some of them were highly developed. Some of them seem to have been more informal, but they were persistent. We even have some evidence that there were tradable products being made by Neanderthals, and that they were moving those products from a production site to other places far away. And there may even have been transactions happening between the Homo sapien Neanderthalensis and the Homo sapiens sapiens. We see tools from one in the camps of the other. Or they may have taken them in raids and attacks and all that, but there does seem to be evidence of trade. So, and the first formalized that we know of with just tons of documents was in the one of the first civilizations in Sumeria, that they were definitely had markets and they were trading with each other, mostly agricultural products, but there were also other products. And of course, the Roman Empire, that was nothing but a giant commercial operation with rather brutal means of acquiring customers and acquiring supplies. Raw resources. But let me take you into the Middle Ages just for a minute. And this is where we set up what a couple of things that are important for what I'm doing in these lectures on capital budgeting. There was the Middle Ages were actually after the fall of the Roman Empire. It was really terrible. They call them the Dark Ages, but you're not supposed to use that term in high academic circles. But it really was dark. Rome had been cut off from Western Europe, from Great Britain, and there was no longer that light of Rome shining across the known world. And so you saw a lot of technologies sliding backward to Neolithic, in some cases, technologies, because Rome wasn't constantly inspiring and moving its technological innovations outward. And so we did have a dark age. And it wasn't all that great. It was pretty miserable. To paraphrase one scholar, you smelled bad, and you died at an early age. That was about how it was. However, in the 1200s, there was a warming period across Western Europe and England, and it was crops grew better, and there was a lot more produce, and that led to a loosening of what was called the feudal system. And this very rigid boundary between the nobles and the people who were not nobles. As a matter of fact, we even have some examples in the censuses, and there were a lot of censuses taken in that era, of non-nobles, not freemen, that is, who actually owned land, which is unheard of in feudal systems. Okay, we had this really great period in the 1200s, and then the weather changed. And not just for one year, it changed in a whole string of years. Most scholars say that it was probably because of a volcano that blew its ass over on the other side of the planet, and it darkened the skies, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and got cold. And of course, all that great stuff fell apart. Now, here's the key for moving into the main point I'm trying to make. We've seen this in other times, in other civilizations, when something goes wrong, the weather or threats from the outside, the class of the upper class, the nobility, tends to get nasty. They start making their, they protecting themselves, gathering wealth to themselves at the expense of the rest of the people. Now, the feudal system worked on the idea that nobles owned all the land, and there would be these other people, you call them serfs, villeins, whatever. They lived on the land, and they would grow crops, raise animals, and they would give some of it to the lord and lady, and then they would have whatever was left for themselves. And these people lived there for generations. There were villages. They called the people who lived in the villages villeins. There were the farmers, the workers in the fields, the serfs, and they took care of the land and they provided for the nobles. When times get bad, and we've seen this across civilizations, the nobles turn mean. They chase the non-nobles off the land. Those people may have lived there for many, many generations, but the nobles say, get off, leave. You come back for the harvest and the planting, but otherwise you do not live on my land anymore. Get out. These are called enclosure movements. Enclosure movements. And we've seen them before, and we may be seeing the very early parts of it now. And you will know that we are starting to get into an enclosure movement within about a year or so. If it doesn't happen within a year or so, it won't happen, probably. At least not that we can tell. But anyway, okay. So here we had all of these people who had formerly had their families for generations, large numbers of people suddenly on the roads, out in nowhere. Oftentimes when that happens, and we see this historically, they will begin to tell rumors about where there is opportunity. In the Dust Bowl days of the American experience back in the 1930s, there were these rumors that California is the place you ought to be, that it's a land of milk and honey. They got jobs out there. They got fruit you can pick off the trees. It's a beautiful place. We all got to go out there. And so you saw one of these movements even in American history, where we had this large-scale movement of groups like the Okies, the Oklahoma people, Kansas people, Nebraska, all going toward California because that's where we'll be okay. In this enclosure movement in the Middle Ages, they heard that the cities were where the jobs were, where there was food, where there was opportunity. So they headed toward them. Kent, London, Cornwall, all these places. You start heading toward the cities because there are jobs there. And that was when the tragedy began, because on the roads you had sick, poor, hungry, pregnant people, men, women, and children. You gave birth along the side of a road. You took a shit under a footbridge. You died beside a tree on your way to this land where there were jobs, called London, and places like that. Well, on the road, people leave behind their trash, their manure, their urine, their lives, even their afterbirths. Whatever it was on the road. So following the people on the roads to the cities were the rats. And on the rats were the fleas. And on the fleas were the plagues. It began with a pneumonic plague, a kind of pneumonia. It killed the weak and weakened the strong. And as they got closer and closer together, compressing in on the cities, the infections began to move rapidly through the populations like death winds. And so came the bubonic plague, the one that built pustules on the skin. And you just prayed to God that they would pop, because if they didn't pop, you would die within a matter of days, and it would not be a very pleasant death. By the end of the bubonic, by the end of the Black Death, it took about maybe 10 years, something like that, as many as 33% of the population of Western Europe and Great Britain were dead. And it wasn't just a human crisis, tragedy. It was an environmental catastrophe because you had dead bodies everywhere. And there were not enough strong people to dig graves to put them in. And the church forbade incineration of the bodies. So they just sat there rotting, adding to the problems. You had King Cholera starting to sweep through. You had all these other ones, tuberculosis and all those. It was nasty and it was brutal. But here's the weird part about it. When it was over, there were a lot of people gone. And the people who were alive had more power. The supply of labor had fallen. So those noblemen, you, I want you to build me a brick house. Well, no. No, not unless you pay me very well. Well, how dare you? Oh, find someone to do it then. Oh, everyone's dead. A plumber? Oh, you want plumbing? Oh, well, we're going to charge you out the ass for that. They began to acquire economic agency, the power to decide their own lives. And with that power, they also began to have freedom of thought, which had never been a part of a system like was in Europe and England. They began to think on their own, and they began to want for things like they had never wanted before. Their tunics, they used to hang down. They were not black. They were this dark, dark, ugly ink color. They started tying them at the waist. Hey, it looks better this way. It feels more comfortable. Form is okay. They began to say, I'd like to try something. I'm so sick of gruel. Let me have something better to eat. Let me have something better to drink than weak beer. And the only reason we make beer is because that gets rid of all the bacteria in the original water. We want more. And so they started demanding new things. And they were getting a small supply of new things. Mostly the rich were getting at it from Asia, the Silk Road, the going out there. These merchants would travel out there, buy from the Chinese, bring it back, but they weren't really that efficient. It was dangerous AF to go out there. A lot of those merchants, unlike Marco Polo, didn't get come back because they were killed and robbed and all that. Okay, set the stage. Curiosity was still driving the system. There was he was a poet, but he was also very close to the kings of and queens of England, and he was also very close to the guildmasters, and his name was Geoffrey Chaucer, probably the greatest poet in England, in all of English literature, but he's not very well known because he wrote in Middle English, whereas Shakespeare wrote in early modern English. So anyway, Chaucer and several others decided that they were going to take the perilous route down to Rome to see what was going on there. Now, most people assumed that Rome had fallen. It was nothing but rubble all over for as far as the eye could see. They got down there. Now, that was a dangerous journey through the mountains. The weather was going to kill them. The highwaymen were going to kill them. The maniacal tribes were going to kill them. They made it. And they came back to tell what they'd seen. And what they said, people say, oh, well, was the ruins, they're all over the place, aren't they? And they said, well, not exactly. Rome is alive. What? Yes. There are, all this stuff is going on. I read literature that didn't talk about, you know, religious things. It talked about love, lust, adventure, danger, war. And they're artists. They're not drawing these pictures, stick figures of angels praying up here with halos around. They're painting actual people. They're sculptors who are making sculptures of real living people naked with all their muscles and the beauty of the human body. You should see it. Oh, that just sent people crazy. Are you kidding me? Did they have food? Oh, yeah, you should see some of the stuff they're getting from Africa across the Mediterranean. And so that began this demand spike for things that we had not had before. That was what was driving those guys like Christopher Columbus, Vasco da Gama, and those kind of Cortes. They were saying, okay, if we can get a route around faster, around the ocean to China, than that perilous, miserable, years-long route through to China, if we can go the other way to get there, well, that is going to be able to create more of these products over there on our shores. Now, no one believed there was a flat Earth. That was, no one had believed that even in ancient Greece. But they did not figure on that ginormous continent called the Americas in the way. So they ran into it. Now, here's the thing, though, is in order to do these perilous, high-risk journeys, they needed capital. That same thing that our businesses need to this day, they needed. They had to get ships, they had to supply the ships, get a crew, pay the crew, and they had to get all the equipment for the ships, everything from navigation equipment to just about anything you could imagine. They even got cats, because cats were the way they kept the mice and rats from eating the food, and they were ready to go, except where's the capital? Well, going to the kings and queens is not a good idea, because contrary to how they wanted to present themselves, they didn't have a whole lot of capital. They just didn't. The way they gathered capital was through wars, which cost money, or through taxing the hell out of the poor people, which they did all the time, but they still didn't have very much capital. So these guys were running around all over the place trying to find sources of capital. And, of course, well, there were very powerful, wealthy families. There was one family that had a monopoly on the salt mines all around Europe. There was, of course, in Italy, there were the de' Medici family was a very powerful family, huge amount of capital, but they weren't the only ones. There were a lot of families that had gathered considerable wealth, and they would be sources of capital. In the case of Christopher Columbus, I'm not sure, I think it was his brother. He was in Italy, and he actually found this rich guy who said, okay, this is interesting, but I'll provide some capital, but the ship that I pay for, I will command. And Columbus said, fine, that's cool. Just, you know, let's get this done. And then he begged some more, and he finally talked Queen Isabella into giving some money to some capital to them. And so he was on his way. But he wasn't the only one, because he was bringing back damn good stuff that sold for a fortune. And it was fast. It was faster than those traders who were walking with carts and mules and ox and horses to China, the land route. These guys were pretty quick by comparison. And what they were bringing back had never been seen, and everyone was going cuckoo over these foods, these fabrics, these ideas that were coming in from the ships that made it back. Now, that means that we had gotten the interest of the capital investors. We had then also shown that we could generate revenue far in excess of the costs. Now, however, these investors were getting a little skittish. They were beginning to demand more information. Now, completely shifting this entire frame over to the middle of mountainous nowhere in a monastery in Italy, where there was a monk. He had taken a permanent vow of silence. Now, he did his usual prayers during the day. He did his work in the gardens and all that, went out among the villagers. But at night, he was developing something unheard of. He was developing a formal rules-based accounting system. It was a double ledger. That accounting system that he invented is the one that you learn in your accounting classes. Rule-based, double ledger. credits and debits, the whole nine yards. That was in Italy. And that got to be very important, because then potential investors could say, we want to see, by the way, his name was Pacioli, and Father Pacioli, and Friar Pacioli. But anyway, they said, we want to see the numbers. We want to see how much you're going to bring in revenue, how much you're going to have in costs, and what the profit's going to be from this, and what the risks are going to be. Show us the numbers. And then we can decide for ourselves whether it's go, accept, or no, reject. And that's where it all begins, with what I'm going to teach you here in this lecture and the next one. We have a name for the subject. It's called capital budgeting decision making. Capital budgeting decision making. The first formal way that this was done, and I have actually seen documents from the 1600s, and there's no question that they were using this method. No question. What is bizarre to me a little bit is that it is still used today. It is flawed, but in some weird way, it kind of works. And I've even seen it in my consulting. A lot of very small companies think in terms of this first method. It's called the payback period method. Payback period method. The two modern methods that I teach you and want you to take with you into your leadership positions of the future are, first, the net present value method and the internal rate of return method. A survey that was done maybe, I don't know, 6-8 years ago, I guess, surveyed companies to see which method they were using predominantly. The thing that is disturbing is that I think it came out with like 25% of the companies are still using the payback period method, that ancient method. And I know it from my consulting. They would just calculate whether to take a project or not, and they were using payback period. These two more modern methods, the NPV and the IRR, was fortunately being used by the majority. Most of the companies prefer the internal rate of return method to the net present value method, which is unfortunate, because even though they're both scientifically, mathematically right, the internal rate of return method has some places where it can fall apart on you. And that's not a good thing. And it's a little bit weaker, but it's still a hell of a lot better than a payback period. So that spreadsheet I showed you, the first worksheet, NPV and IRR. They're not hard to calculate. Just understanding what they're telling you might be. But it all boils down to something very simple. There will be a number, and it will tell you yes or no, accept or reject. It all boils down to a single number in these two systems right here. And that's what frustrates everyone who puts a project to the finance people in a company. Because we say yes or no, and they say, wait a minute, why? Give us a break. Why? This is a great project. And we say, no. That's all there is to it. It's simple. The math that goes into it might be daunting, unless you've got a spreadsheet, in which case it's easy. But it's just a yes or a no. And that'll set the stage for us to do this next in the lecture on Wednesday. For now, I want you to get yourselves ready to take the test, the quiz, and when you're finished with it, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.